Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, Chemours is launching an effort to bring STEM education to middle school students in underrepresented groups.
Young people will be able to feel more comfortable in STEM. Young people will be able to look at themselves in the world of STEM and start looking at high school and college options and job and career options based off of those experiences.
Contributor Larry Nagengast takes a closer look at the program and its potential impact locally. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also head back to the UD Center for Political Communications National Agenda Series to highlight another discussion there this fall. Arts Playlist introduces us to the photographer behind an exhibit at the Historic Odessa Foundation. And Enlighten Me features a conversation with the new commander at Dover Air Force Base. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. STEM education has received a lot of attention in recent years, especially efforts to reach girls and minorities, two groups underrepresented in many STEM fields. Those efforts often center on high school and college students. But this week, Wilmington-based Chemours launched a new initiative, ChemFest, focused on middle school. And it's launching at a pair of Wilmington schools serving those groups underrepresented in STEM. Contributor Larry Nagengast takes a closer look at this initiative and what it means for those schools in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found. So let's start with this thumbnail sketch of what Chemours ChemFest program is. What is it? What makes it unique?
Okay, well, you know, let's just start with what ChemFest is. It's a shorthand. It stands for Chemours Future of Engineering, Science, Trades, and Technology. And as you indicated, it is a program that's aimed at promoting learning and opportunities in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, and it's focused on middle schools. Now, ultimately, this is going to be a global program, reaching all of the communities around the world where Chemours has operations, but it's starting in Wilmington because that's where Chemours has its headquarters. Now, it's significant that the program focuses on middle schools because it's when kids are in the fifth to eighth grade that they should at least get started thinking about careers. Even more significant is that this initiative is going to focus on underrepresented and often overlooked student demographics, talking here about children from low-income families and especially girls. On top of that, this is not going to be a one-size-fits-all initiative. The programs that Chemours intends to fund are going to be customized to meet the specific needs of each school that it decides to partner with.
So, as you noted, Chemours is starting this program in its own backyard at two Wilmington schools. Let's look at them one by one, starting with Eastside Charter. The investment there is pretty substantial. What's that going to look like, and what's it going to do for students there?
Well, at Eastside, which is a kindergarten through eighth grade school in the northeast corner of the city, Chemours is putting up $4 million to become the primary funder of a $13 million construction project for what's going to be called the Chemours Eastside STEM Discovery Hub. It's going to be a separate building next to the existing Eastside Charter School. Besides the classrooms and the science labs that you would expect it to have, it will also have a maker space equipped with 3D printers, robotics and other technology, and a demonstration area and meeting rooms. Aaron Bass, Eastside's CEO, is really excited about the possibilities. He thinks it can provide his students with opportunities to explore all types of science. He's even talking about everything from software coding up to hydroponic gardening. And he's enthused that this is not just going to be a building. It's going to be a place that scientists from Chemours can visit regularly to help in the labs and to serve as mentors as well.
The hope is this is going to be more than a school investment, that it will also extend into the community. How so?
Well, at the end of the school day, this Discovery Hub is going to become a place where Chemours and perhaps other businesses as well can recruit workers and even train them. And it'll be a place where community organizations can hold meetings. On top of that, the Wilmington Library is going to join this partnership, offering some of its own programming there, so residents of that part of the city won't have to travel as far to benefit from some library services. Now, when it's built, the hub is likely to become a signature piece in the revitalization of the Riverside community, where 600 new housing units are being built on the east side to replace an aging public housing project. In some respects, this new building is going to be functioning like a community center, a gathering place that's going to promote learning and career training, not only for the middle school kids, but for their parents and for the other adults in the community.
So how about the other school involved in this rollout of ChemFest here in Wilmington?
Well, the other partnering school for Chemours is Serviam Girls Academy, a school that a lot of people might not know very much about. It's a private school that doesn't charge tuition. It enrolls only 60 or so girls from lower income families in grades 5 through 8. It started in 2008 and had been housed in a closed Catholic school near Newcastle until it moved into Great Grace Methodist Church in downtown Wilmington a year ago. Now, Chemours has awarded Serviam $250,000 to set up a capstone science program for its eighth grade students. The program will start next year, and the details are still being worked out, but the idea here is that students are going to pick out a project, and that it's something that they would be working on all year long, and scientists from Chemours would be serving as their mentors. In addition, Chemours is going to continue its current support for the school. It does things like supplying the science lab, assist the science teacher, and its employees visit the school to talk with students about science careers.
So there is kind of a through line here that you can draw from what Chemours is doing with this initiative and some of what the company it was born out of, DuPont, used to do, right? I mean, there is a close similarity here.
Well, yes, there was. And, you know, there was certainly some concern 5 or 6 years ago in that period when DuPont merged with Dow Chemical and then started spinning off Chemours and some other pieces of its operation into separate business entities. The concern then was that Wilmington and really all of Delaware would lose some of that corporate largesse for which DuPont was so well known. Now, DuPont has always been a big supporter of education in the state and was pretty good with its outreach into minority communities as well. It started a program called FAME back in the 1970s to promote opportunities for minority children in science and engineering. FAME is still going strong, as are other programs that DuPont started years ago. What Chemours is doing now with ChemFest is essentially following in the footsteps of its corporate forefather.
So how significant is reaching these underrepresented groups at a younger age? And why do all those involved believe that this makes a real difference to reach down into middle schools and not wait until kids get to high school to really push STEM?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, and I did a lot of research on this a couple of years ago, career training experts say that kids should start thinking about what they want to do with their lives when they're in middle school. The choices they make while in middle school aren't going to necessarily lock them in, but it will at least start giving them a feel for what they like and what they don't like. And it becomes a stepping stone for what you'll learn in high school and what areas you're going to specialize in and work your way through. Now, Mark Newman, who's the CEO of Chemours, mentioned this week that there are going to be 800,000 new STEM jobs created in the United States in the next 20 years. And right now, there just aren't enough professionals available to fill them. Chemours sees ChemFest as a way to build a pipeline starting in the middle school to help fill these positions. Now, educators like Aaron Bass at Eastside and Peggy Hines at Serviam see ChemFest as a way of opening the eyes of their students and opening doors of opportunity to them as well, showing them a path to a brighter future through careers in science and in engineering.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. His piece on Chemours' ChemFest program and its impact in Wilmington is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next, The Green heads to the University of Delaware to check in on the UD Center for Political Communications annual National Agenda Series and one of its recent conversations. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This week, we return to the University of Delaware Center for Political Communications National Agenda Series. The theme this fall is Reflecting America, examining how the current atmosphere of political divides, social movements, and economic upheavals fueled by the pandemic and politics is redefining America. The series started in September with NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid and award-winning novelist David Joy. The two appeared together to revisit their National Agenda Series appearance 4 years ago when they discussed the country's geographical, religious, and cultural differences. The UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director Lindsay Hoffman moderated the conversation, and she joins us again this week to discuss it with us.
Why did you decide to bring them back now 4 years later, particularly to kick off this theme of Reflecting America?
Sure. Well, I encourage folks, even though these conversations take place at a certain place at a certain time, I've really found when I go back and look at them that some of them are often very timeless, and I think that this conversation was definitely one of those. I brought Asma back because she has a really unique perspective on covering the White House. The last time she was here, she had covered the Trump campaign. So this was 2017 that she came back, and she actually left the political desk and was doing, I think, reporting on technology and business. And she said, I don't think I'll ever go back to reporting on politics. So part of me was just curious as to, you know, why she came back to the political world. She's also a Muslim American woman, and David Joy is an Appalachian man who both of them come from different parts of the country, different backgrounds, and I've found that when our students, you know, particularly, I grew up in Kentucky, and so sometimes when I tell students that, they look at me like I've got three heads. They're like, wait, what? And I think a lot of people at the University of Delaware, a lot of students who come here regionally from Long Island, New Jersey, et cetera, they haven't really been around people who are very, very different from them. So that's one of the reasons I bring people like that in, is I want to bring people in who are someone that they're not accustomed to being around necessarily, because then you realize, oh, wait, it's just another human being. Like, this isn't some sort of strange, like, you know, particularly with David Joy, he's got that really strong Southern North Carolina accent. And to hear some of the things that come out of his mouth, it's almost like, this does not compute. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, you know, we brought these people in, we brought both of them in separately in 2017, and so in Trump's first year. And I thought, let's bring them back, you know, this year in Biden's first year, because Biden was one of my speakers that year as well. But I think he's kind of busy these days, so I don't think he was available to come back. I was really pleased to have the conversation with the two of them because they also are so different from each other. Mm-hmm. And that models to the students and to the people watching that you can find things in common even when you know, have totally different religious backgrounds, totally different attitudes towards guns, totally different geographical backgrounds. That's what I find that really exciting, to see those kinds of conversations take place.
One of the topics you discussed with the two of them was how people get their news today. You noted a recent poll showed that outlets known for putting out misinformation have more engagement on social media than more trustworthy news sources. Asma Khalid talked a little bit specifically to that point. She had this to say. Let's listen to that exchange.
I think one of the challenges, though, is that every, like, platform that I'm mentioning also, in my view, has, like, tremendous ills, right? Like, I feel like podcasting has also allowed for people to really just kind of, like, dig deeper into these horrible echo chambers where you're only going to listen to, like, the flashy celebrities who you already agree with. I find social media terribly destructive in some ways. Like, Facebook, to me, every time I get on there, it's just, you know, I mean, this is a whole nother issue, but, like, you know, we talk about masking and vaccine mandates, and I read stuff from, like, old friends from high school, and it's just, you know, people have, like, people across the board will just reinforce opinions that they already have on social media platforms. And so I'm a big believer that a lot of the divides we talk about in terms of, like, civil discourse would not exist if social media did not also exist, which I know is a complete, like, hypothetical. You can't prove that, what I'm saying.
So, Lindsay, how can we resolve this tension between the ills of social media that Asma was talking about and the fact that, you know, a large number of people relied on it for their news and information, and that's not going to change anytime soon. So I guess the part of this is trying to just make people smarter about it, right?
Yeah, it's a tough one. And of course, since that conversation, we've now discovered that Facebook's own internal research has demonstrated a lot of negative effects, ill effects on people who rely on that for their news. So I think that, you know, I'm not suggesting, you know, get off of social media altogether. I think that there are some personal and family links on, mm-hmm. on things like Facebook that help you stay connected with your family, particularly during a pandemic. But I do think that that's not necessarily the place to get news. And I think that what I often tell my students is to diversify their portfolio, so their media portfolio. So look for news from other countries. Follow, you know, Al Jazeera and the BBC, and listen to public radio and public television that aren't going to be so driven by advertising and by commercial interests. Because there's a reason that, you know, a lot of these cable news shows have very extreme, loud voices, because psychology tells us we're often drawn to the negative. So if you think about it, we have sort of a negativity bias. We often remember things, bad things that happen to us more than we remember the good things. Or if we watch, this is why negative political ads still work so well, because people remember the negativity. So, you know, step away from those kind of those shouting matches, and you know, try to find, go to original sources. Facebook and Twitter can be a good sort of starting place, perhaps, but certainly never retweet or quote something that you have not read. Mm-hmm. And look at the link. Is that a link to a valid news source, or is that a pundit, or is that a blog, a person's personal blog?
Sure.
There's something called the sleeper effect, where we often might see something in the news or on Facebook, realize that it's false or it's from a biased source, but later on remember the story, but forget the part about it being from a biased source, and we then share that information again. So we have to be very, very careful about sourcing. That's, I think, the number one thing is who is telling the story. And I think particularly for younger people, I don't think they always know, and actually this is probably true for older people too, I don't think they always know what is an opinion column versus a news analysis versus a factual news story.
Right.
And I actually think, the news media could do a better job of helping people understand
presenting it,
what those things are. Not just the little...
Not the little... The little words, more explicitly.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that would create, I think, greater trust in the news media as well, which, you know, they're suffering from a great lack of trust among Americans right now.
You also talked about a willingness to be uncomfortable being important to civic discourse. David Joy specifically addressed that. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Seek out discomfort. Seek out things that are challenging. That's the only time that you experience growth. You can think about it from a bodybuilding standpoint if you want to. If you pick up 5-pound weights all the time, you know, you're never going to build muscle. The way that you build muscle is to break those muscles down, rebuild them. Your brain's the same way. You need to seek out these places, these situations, these conversations, these people that make you uncomfortable and challenge the things that you believe. And only through a constant challenging of your beliefs are you ever able to truly solidify, you know, what it is that you believe.
So, Lindsay, do you think younger people, your students, for example, are more willing to be uncomfortable and challenge their beliefs than, say, people in their 40s, their 50s, seniors?
That's a really interesting question, and I've thought about generational differences a lot. I've done some research on generational differences, but now I've been at UD long enough to have taught both millennials and Gen Z, and I don't think it's a young person phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I feel that maybe 10, 15 years ago, there were more students who wanted to censor speech, who wanted safe spaces, And now I'm seeing much more receptivity to what I'm calling brave spaces, creating places where students can speak up. And they want to learn how to have these kinds of conversations. And again, I think being isolated, you know, imagine yourself as a college freshman, sophomore, whatever, spending that time at home. You think about it, probably about half of our students before the semester had never stepped foot on a college campus.
Right.
Even for their campus visit, right? That was virtual too.
Right.
So they haven't been acculturated into what it's like to have, you know, groups on campus holding up signs that are maybe homophobic or holding up anti-abortion signs that have pictures, you know, gruesome pictures of fetuses. So I'm seeing the younger people kind of reacting to speech like that on campus in a sort of a very reactionary way. Whereas my older students, juniors and seniors, are kind of like, well, that's just what happens on a college campus. Mm-hmm. You know, we're used to that. So I hesitate to answer if that's like a generational thing, because I think it's just...
So maybe just your experience.
Yeah, I think it's your experience. And I think it has a lot to do with the time period that you are coming of age. Mm-hmm. I do think that older people tend to get more settled in their ways, obviously. And I think that they don't always give young people the room to express their opinion. I hear from a lot of my students how, you know, I teach them about how to talk to your family members who disagree with you, and they'll go home for Thanksgiving and come back, and they're like, you know, I tried talking to my uncle, but he just said, you're young, you don't know what you're talking about. And and I think that it's incumbent upon older people to research demonstrates that when parents talk to their kids in a way that is parallel rather than hierarchical, they're going to be more politically interested. They're going to be more politically engaged. They're going to vote. They're going to pay attention to news. And I think those are all good things that our American citizens should be doing. So I don't know if it's necessarily generational thing as much as it is a sort of life growth thing, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Sure. Anything else stand out to you about the conversation with these two? And, you know, they didn't necessarily seem super optimistic about the country overcoming all these divisions and mm-hmm. polarization. How about you? I mean, do you feel more optimistic than less optimistic about where we're headed?
Well, I always try to be optimistic. I feel like there's an importance to being truthful about, and I really appreciated their both of their viewpoints about this being kind of a dark period. But I also think that with every pendulum swing one way, there becomes a pendulum swing the other way, and what we can do right now, even though it might seem like dark times and people are really divided and, you know, there's a lot of things that are maybe wrong with culture or wrong with government or, you know, government not getting things done, you name it. There's a lot of things we could complain about right now. But if I can just sit down with you, Tom, or, you know, with one of my students and just have a real conversation about, you know, our lives and what matters, and that's uplifting to me. And maybe that change happens at a very, very small scale. But I do think that if you can change the culture at, say, the University of Delaware to be one where students leave this university and say, you know, that was a place where I could raise my voice, where I felt I had my voice heard, and where I heard voices that were different from my own. If you can change that, and that's kind of my goal, I think that has a lot to say for down the road what these students are going to be as adults when they're in our shoes.
Thanks to the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director Lindsay Hoffman for joining us this week on The Green. Lindsay will return in the coming weeks to talk about some of the other Reflecting America National Agenda Series events this fall. You can watch this one and other previous National Agenda Series events and get information on upcoming events at cpc.udel.edu. Next on The Green, it's Arts Playlist, where we meet the photographer behind an exhibition at the historic Odessa Foundation. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Historic Odessa Foundation's latest exhibition, Island Life, Photography by Jay Fleming, documents a disappearing way of life on two Chesapeake Bay islands. Jay Fleming grew up in Annapolis and spent more than a decade traveling to the Chesapeake's last two inhabited offshore islands, Smith Island and Tangier Island. This exhibition features Fleming's photographs from those islands compiled for his latest book, Island Life. And he joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist to discuss his work.
You've got this new exhibition coming to the historic Odessa Foundation. Actually, it's already up. It'll be up through December 31st. It's called Island Life Photography by Jay Fleming. Let's talk about the exhibit. What can people expect?
So the exhibit features about 10 pieces that reflect a body of work that I created on Smith Island and Tangier Island, both of which are the last two inhabited offshore islands in the Chesapeake Bay. And by offshore, I mean that the islands are not connected to the mainland by a bridge. So the communities on these islands are only accessible by either an airplane, in the case of Tangier, which has an airport, or a boat. So these islands are isolated and incredibly unique, and they kind of, you know, the communities kind of have been hanging on to the traditions of the past and the way of life that has sustained the communities for over 200 years.
What got you interested in doing this? I am familiar with Smith and Tangier Islands. I've been in Delaware for a long time, so I'm familiar. But what got you interested in doing this project specifically about Smith and Tangier Islands?
So the first time that I went to one of the islands was in 2009, and I went out to photograph the brown pelican nesting colony on Smith. And at the time, I was incredibly invested in wildlife photography. That's kind of what I focused on as a young photographer. I think I was just out of college. And I read about the brown pelican nesting colony online and in some other books, and decided to make a trip out there myself. I loaded my kayak onto the ferry in Crisfield, went over to the island, had a tent in my kayak, and once I arrived, I paddled down to the brown pelican nesting colony, kind of the area where I thought they'd be, and basically set up shop and photographed them in the evening, camped out in the marsh that night, and photographed them again in the morning with the sunrise light. And to me, it was just an incredibly inspiring experience, fascinating to see these birds with their chicks and sitting on eggs, and it was just an incredible experience, and I couldn't wait to get back to photograph them again. So I went back again to photograph the pelicans, but every time that I went back, I made more contact with the people in the community there, and I came to realize how unique the community was, and you know how the community was changing, and ultimately I felt a sense of urgency to document the community in every facet of the way of life, which is represented in this book.
How are the communities unique? Describe that for my listeners.
So both communities, as I mentioned, are pretty isolated. There's no bridge that connects Smith or Tangier to the mainland. And, in order for the people on the islands to, do something simple like get food, it's a lot different from, how we live on the mainland. Healthcare is very different. The infrastructure on the islands, like electricity and education, it's all different. So the isolation has shaped these communities. Like I said, for over 200 years, they've been, existing kind of in balance with the Chesapeake Bay and the forces of the Chesapeake Bay.
Jay, I don't know if you'll have an answer to this or not, but did COVID impact these communities differently than in other places?
Yes, COVID had a huge impact on both islands. Both islands remained relatively free of COVID up until about December of 2020. And after that, COVID got out to Tangier and affected quite a few people. It spread very quickly on the island, and just as it did on Smith, but tragically on Tangier, three people passed from COVID and COVID-related complications. So it really spread throughout the community. It spread quickly once it got to the island. I think the islanders had a sense, there was a sense of security due to that isolation. They didn't feel like COVID could actually reach the island, and people were pretty laid back about masks and, you know, COVID-related precautions up until COVID actually got to the island, and then people started taking it very, very seriously. And the Somerset County Health Department, which is the county in Maryland that services Smith Island, they actually went out and did like a vaccination clinic in March, and over 50 people got vaccinated on that one day. And Accomack County, Virginia did something similar on Tangier. So the islanders did realize that, you know, their isolation wasn't going to protect them from COVID because they, you know, there is quite a bit of contact with the mainland, with, you know, boats running and people working on the mainland and going back and forth.
So this exhibit called Island Life, Photography by Jay Fleming, is made up of a selection of photographs from Jay Fleming's newest book, Island Life. Along with the exhibition, you'll be giving an artist talk at the Historic Odessa Foundation?
Yes, on November 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. I'll be at the Historic Odessa Foundation giving a talk and showing unpublished images from the book along with published images, and just kind of answering questions. You know, there's a lot of curiosity surrounding these islands, and, you know, I'll be able to reflect upon more than 10 years of going out there and documenting the community, the wildlife, and the environment out there.
I was going to ask you how long you worked on this, and you just answered that. So 10 years?
Well, actually more than 10 years. So the first photograph that's featured in the book is a photograph of a group of brown pelicans in that nesting colony, and that was taken in May of 2009. So the book reflects a body of work from May of 2009 to June of 2021, so 12 years of work.
Do you have a favorite photograph?
I do. I have multiple favorite photographs, but I think the one that's most significant to me is a photograph of the last house on Holland Island. And Holland Island has an incredible story on its own. Holland Island is about 10 miles north of Smith, and Holland was inhabited up until the early 1900s, about 1910. Holland Island had a thriving community, 70-plus homes, 375 people approximately, a schoolhouse, stores, so on and so forth. And, you know, like the other inhabited islands on the bay, the residents of Holland kind of saw the writing on the wall with the erosion. The island was essentially washing away and claiming large chunks of land and really diminishing the size of the island over the years. And the residents of the island packed up and moved, like I said, around 1910. And I have a picture of the last house that remained on Holland Island, which people left there. And I photographed the house in 2010, just prior to it falling in. And that house, I was in my kayak, and I photographed it real low to the water on a really calm day. So the reflection of the house kind of gives the feel that the house is like melting into the water. It's very symbolic of the islands on the Chesapeake Bay.
Jay, what's your background? How did you get into photography?
So photography to me kind of came natural. My father, Kevin Fleming, is a photographer. And at a young age, I was, you could say, exposed. I know that's a cheesy photography joke, but I was exposed to the craft and really just growing up around it. I feel like gave me an eye for composition. And when I was 13, I kind of took interest in it, and my dad let me use one of his old 35-millimeter film cameras. And I would go out and shoot with him and shoot on my own, and then he would have the film processed. And from there, it just developed into, you know, me going out more and more on my own and ultimately getting a digital camera. And I think about 2005, and those were the early days of digital, so the cameras were pretty limited, but still it allowed me to experiment and to, you know, really kind of develop my own style. And, just evolved into me documenting things that I'm interested in and things that I'm passionate about, like Smith Island and Tangier Island.
What's next for Jay Fleming?
So over the past couple years, I've been doing a bit of traveling amidst working on Island Life and other projects. I've been going to different locations up and down the East Coast to document commercial fishing on the Atlantic Ocean. And I've been out shark fishing, commercial shark fishing in North Carolina. I've done an 8-day scalloping trip out of Seaford, Virginia. And actually most recently I went up to Maine and New Brunswick, Canada to document the lobster fishery and herring fisheries up there. So my goal from these trips is to create another book that is what I would describe as like a visual narrative of fisheries in the Atlantic Ocean. So this project, which I'm probably going to call Atlantic Harvest, is very similar to what I've done already on the Chesapeake Bay for my first photography book, which was called Working the Water.
Thanks to photographer Jay Fleming and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. Island Life, photography by Jay Fleming, runs through December 31st at the Historic Odessa Foundation's Visitor Center. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a conversation with the new commander at Dover Air Force Base. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Dover Air Force Base recently welcomed new leadership when Colonel Matthew Huseman took command of the 436th Airlift Wing. He most recently served as vice commander at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, but he's no stranger to Dover, this being his third stint at the base here in the state's capital. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry introduces us to the new commander who shared his goals for the base and how he honors those who served this Veterans Day week.
You find yourself in charge here in Dover. What goals do you have for the base?
It's a great question that every commander sits down and goes through. And I'll tell you that the first focus that we have is we look towards our mission to deliver and take care of airmen around the globe and work for the United States in that sense. But I think as we break it down of goals for the base, it's as airmen that we can take care of each other, that we can work for each other's families, that as we're out rocking this mission across the globe, that we're able to know that our family members and that our friends are being taken care of back here at home in Dover and across this Delaware community that we live in. That's one of the main goals, and to continue to strengthen the relationship with our downtown partners, because this community means so much to our team that we're able to go out and execute the mission of delivering airlift around the globe, and that we're also able to be here and with our port mortuary here to be able to welcome home our heroes. And so as a whole, that goal boils down to being able to take care of each other throughout everything that we do, to make sure that we care for each other, that we're ready for every fight that could come our way, and that we're looking at innovative ways to improve our readiness and innovative ways in which to take care of each other.
When you assumed command, you told airmen that they make the impossible possible and make it look easy. Can you speak to their readiness to respond to the unexpected as well as the way they carry out their daily mission?
I think we have to look no further than the recent NEO, Joe, on that one. Is as General Minahan said a couple of weeks ago, the world looked to AMC and said, "You're not going to be able to do this." And AMC as a whole said, "Just watch us." Dover Airmen took up that flag and said, "Let's go, just watch us." And they really did. And they've been ready all across the board to execute not just something that looks like a NEO, but anything that comes our way and make sure that flexibility, because their training takes time to look at different aspects of the way in which we need to be able to execute our global mission. And so as we go through that, that training, whether that's flying training or that's our port dogs on the ground or our Ravens in the way in which they train as security forces and defenders of our base and of our aircraft, we're able to do that along with our medics that are able to take and get onto the cutting edge of medicine to be able to take care of whatever mission it is around the globe. All of the groups at Dover, both our total force partners and our AFMEO partners and JPEDs and AFMEs, we're all focused on training for whatever part of a mission that we're looking at so that we can be broad enough to understand how our readiness needs to be across the full spectrum.
You've been to a lot of places during your career. What do you think about Delaware and Dover and what sets it apart from other places you have served?
So, Joe, Delaware is, it is, it's like family to me. This is the third time I've been stationed here. We started here as a family, as young lieutenants. I had my first daughter here, and it's just coming home. And it's hard to explain that. What Delaware brings is the people, and it's woven throughout the fabric of this community of how the people care for airmen and for their families, how they're not afraid to put the needs of others above their own. And they do that on a day in and day out basis. You can see it from the volunteers on the base that come in for everything from the families of the fallen to the USO to our honorary commanders that bring a different perspective for each one of our squadrons and our units across the base to be able to have discussions to just when we go out the gate in the communities in which we live in to our neighbors that sit down and just want to have a discussion and just want to make sure that we're taken care of in the way in which they're able to do things. Dover's unique in that sense and being able to work together to work through any differences we have and to move forward. And now I have the unique ability to actually even go work and chat with the Chamber of Commerce of Central Delaware, which is an awesome opportunity to be able to talk with many different leaders from across the area and to see how we as a group can make this part of Delaware even better as we move forward.
Now, it's Veterans Day week, and what are your thoughts on Veterans Day and how the Dover Air Force Base marks the occasion?
So Veterans Day is a very special week that sits out and we honor millions of the brave men and women who have served our country throughout the years. And I think that there's many stories and each person Veterans Day brings something different to their mind when they think about what Veterans Day is about. Here on Veterans Day, we held a dedication ceremony for a new POW MIA exhibit at Air Mobility Command Museum. And the Air Mobility Command Museum is an outstanding place to be able to come and look at our heritage. And as we celebrate that heritage and we look upon what has gone on in the past, we are reminded of the shoulders of the giants that we stand on today as we lead forward into the future. And they dedicated an exhibit that's called the Chair of Honor. This exhibit is an unoccupied C-5M Super Galaxy pilot seat. That unoccupied seat is honoring those who are still POW or MIA and symbolizes that their place will be in the museum and it'll be waiting for their return. That symbology about what it is that we care for in our veterans, it is just ever important to me. I didn't grow up in a military family, but I grew up with an uncle who served in the U.S. Air Force. And my uncle actually just passed away a few months ago. And so as I think back to what he did and how he represented our U.S. Air Force and our nation across the globe, it is a great day for me to be able to reflect upon that and how I hope to continue on his legacy of leadership and the way in which he took care of airmen and the way in which he integrated into the communities to make the United States the greatest nation in the world.
How do the programs at the base and at the Department of Defense support veterans and airmen transitioning back into civilian life?
So we have a program that's built for that. It's called TAP. It's a transition assistance program. But beyond that program, there are multiple ways that we do that. And I'll tell you, the Delaware community is awesome in the way in which they join with us to help skill bridge our airmen into that next step. Because whether an airman serves 4 years, 6 years, 26 years, what we want them to know is that the Air Force cared about them, but also that as they go out the door, we want them to be amazing humans and going out to contribute to the United States in the way in which we all try to as leaders. And so I think that as we bridge through that, there are programs that work through it, but also it's just how we as a team come together to help airmen as they transition out of the Air Force into that next job of whatever that's going to be for their future so that they're prepared to be the best citizens as they can be.
What makes veterans great employees and entrepreneurs?
So we all start with a baseline that we all go through called basic training. And so that's a breakdown of how we are built together and how we have this common bond. But we're always looking to be part of something that's bigger than ourselves. And so that service before self discussion is something that is, if I were an entrepreneur or a business owner, as I look at that, knowing that someone is not selfish, that they're looking out for the needs of their fellow workers, that they're able to balance their home life and their own personal needs to take care of the folks around them is what I think makes them a great worker, and also their work ethic, because they're not afraid to do the hard job. And so that gives them that chance to be able to go out and be ready into the new workforce that they go into as they transition out of the Air Force.
The majority of people have not served in the military. What would you want people to know about veterans and service members on this Veterans Day week, and how best can we support them?
I think, Joe, that the thing is as we as veterans go through our day-to-day life, we do this because we're called to. This is more than a job. It is a calling. It is something that we love to be a part of. And so as on Veterans Day, we're not expecting a thank you. We're not expecting anything. We enjoy this day as a time to celebrate with our fellow veterans, but also to celebrate what it is that we have been able to do as military members in the United States. And the way in which we're able to bond together as fellow veterans and to support our community, we love being able to support the freedoms that this country stands for. And we swear upon that when we talk about our oath of allegiance our oath of office to the Constitution. And I really believe that that's really on this Veterans Day what we want to celebrate, is that we are serving together with the American public, and we are here to take care of them and their freedoms, and we're willing to sacrifice that on any given day, and that's what we love as part of our job, is that calling to do that. This is not our job. This is our calling.
Thanks to Dover Air Force Base Commander Colonel Matthew Huseman and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagyes, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry and Kelly Steele, and our show producer, Rebecca Baer. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.